I'm going to give you the G-rated version of a story. It's the person I'm going to talk about here at the moment. Okay, so many years ago, I know it's not that popular now, but some of you are familiar with that you can use like AIM to chat online. And a friend and I were chatting online with each other, and we had these two other friends. Everybody was at work at the time. I was the pastor at the time. I was doing my job, but I also chat sometimes, not anymore. But anyways, so we were chatting with each other, and we realized these two friends we're kind of goofing around at work, and so what we started doing was we kind of collaborated. Actually, the person I was chatting with was Matt Tang's oldest brother, and we decided that, well, wouldn't it be funny if we just tried to pull a short, you know, kind of a little prank on these two other friends of ours. And so what we did was we created new screen names that were very similar to these two other friends' screen names. And so we'll just call them Robert and Phil, okay? And so I pretended that I was, I can't remember which it was, but I think I pretended I was Phil, and Matt's oldest brother pretended that he was Robert, and we were chatting the opposite person and trying to convince them, like, you know what, I had to create a new screen name because my screen account got hacked by someone, so whoever is chatting you from my screen name, just ignore them. Add them to your block list, don't talk to them, and we convinced them that they were hacked. And then we kept talking to them, and the goal, as the prank kept going further and further, because they were buying into it, we tried to convince them, you know what, that the other person wanted to go meet together in a very far away, random spot, and that we had something very important to talk about with the other person. And the goal was hoping that they would get together and actually drive to this very far place and stand there, so what do you want to talk about? You asked me, what do you want to talk about? And I have this long, like, ridiculous conversation that had no point meeting in this faraway spot. Now, I got to tell you, it was pretty difficult because we were both trying to imitate the mannerisms of the person we were pretending to be, and they began to, like, ask questions to confirm whether or not it was really the other person. But fortunately, we knew our friends well enough that we were able to answer, you know, some of those questions, like, when is your birthday, who's your girlfriend, those kind of things, and we had just enough truth, right? We had just enough of the truth to kind of convince them, but they were still a little bit suspicious. And I think when we are honest with ourselves, that sometimes we feel that way about God. And what I mean by that is, you know, we know that there's some truth in the Bible. There's just enough truth that it could be true, but what if that's it, just that little portion that we know is factually or historically true? How can I trust an invisible God? And so this morning we're going to take a look at that question. And so if you have a Bible, I want you to turn in it to Acts chapter 25. We're in this series called Kinetic, where we're learning about how Jesus moves his people from potential energy that's just sitting there to the kinetic movement of God in our lives, in our world, as his church. And previously, in previous passages, we learned that there were a bunch of Jewish religious leaders who didn't like Paul, the Apostle Paul. They didn't like him preaching about Jesus, especially as both Jewish people and non-Jewish people were turning to Christ and worshiping together, which is very against the Jewish culture of the time. And so they had Paul arrested when he returned to Jerusalem after his third missions trip. But as you know, the nation of Israel at that time was under the rule of the Roman Empire. And so they couldn't just punish him or exact their version of vengeance on him. They have to bring legal charges before an official Roman court in the local seat of government, which was in the city of Caesarea. And so the original Roman governor of the region, his name was Felix, if you remember, he found that Paul was not guilty of violating any Roman law. But in order to keep this contingent of Jewish religious leaders in Jerusalem happy, he left Paul in prison for 2 years. And during those 2 years, he was curious about Christianity. He had conversations again and again with Paul, and he was exposed to the truth about Jesus, but his heart remained unchanged. And if you remember, we were examining ourselves to see what were those three detours that Felix experienced that we also experienced that detours us from experiencing Jesus. And so that's that next slide, Jonathan, because the first detour that we talked about was how Felix was afraid of giving up the sins that he likes, and that we often also get detoured from Jesus for the same reason. Secondly, that Felix was distracted from Jesus because he finds his security in having more rather than finding security in knowing God and his provision. And thirdly, that he cared more about pleasing people than pleasing God. And so he was unable to see Jesus. And so that's some of our struggles as well. But what happened, and as Dennis preached about last week, is that this governor, Felix, he was actually removed from office. He was impeached due to his corruption in his government. And so there was a new governor installed by Caesar, who's the Roman emperor. And this guy's name is Porcius Festus. And he actually is going to turn out to be a fairly ethical leader. And so what I'm thinking about for us this morning is that perhaps you don't feel like you're as corrupt of a person as Felix the cat, but instead that you're more like Festus. You know, he's a pretty decent guy, and what he uncovers, what we're going to uncover through this brief appearance with him, is some factors that might deter us from being able to trust and see Jesus, that deters us from experiencing a kinetic life with God. So we're going to pick up in chapter 25, verse 13. Now, when some days had passed, Agrippa, the king, and Bernice arrived at Caesarea, that's that city, and greeted Festus the governor. And as they stayed there many days, Festus laid Paul's case before the king, saying, "There's a man left prisoner by Felix, and when I was at Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of the Jews laid out their case against him, asking for a sentence of condemnation against him. I answered them that it was not the custom of the Romans to give up anyone before the accused met the accusers face to face and had opportunity to make his defense concerning the charge laid against him. So, when they came together here, I made no delay." That means he went to this speedy trial, but on the next day took my seat on the tribunal and ordered the man to be brought. When the accusers stood up, they brought no charge in his case of such evils as I supposed. Rather, they had certain points of dispute with him about their own religion and about a certain Jesus who was dead, but whom Paul asserted to be alive. Let's stop right there. So what's happening in this passage, in this historical account, is in verse 13, Governor Festus has a surprise of visitors in town. This man who's known as Herod Agrippa II. Now, he is the Jewish regional king over these minor territories around the region, and he's appointed by Caesar because the Roman Empire has complete rule over this area. So he's allowed to rule over Jerusalem. Now, if you remember, way back when we talked about Governor Felix, his wife, Drusilla, is actually his sister. And so this guy, he's obviously, because he's Herod Agrippa II, he's the son of Herod Agrippa I and the great-grandson of Herod the Great, the Jewish king that was ruling over Jerusalem during the time of Jesus. And what we know historically is that he will be the last of the kings of Israel. After him, there will be no more kings, because of the Roman Empire crushing the rule in Jerusalem. And he comes into Caesarea with his half-sister, Bernice. In verse 14, the governor invites them over to his gubernatorial palace to talk about Paul's case that he inherited from this previous regime in Felix. And in verse 15, he describes how he went all the way to the Jewish hometown of Jerusalem to hear out these religious leaders and their council, their request to punish Paul with the death penalty. And so his response is that Roman custom forbids a death sentence without allowing Paul, who is a Roman citizen, to have a fair trial. So in verse 17, they went all the way back to the local seat of government, back in Caesarea, and unlike his predecessor, unlike Felix, he did everything by the book. He had a speedy trial the next day. He convened a tribunal to judge the case between the plaintiffs, the religious Jewish leaders of Jerusalem, and the defendant, who is Paul. And in verse 18, his conclusion is, "The Jewish accusers didn't bring up any evidence that I would consider breaking the law or that would warrant a death sentence according to Roman custom." And so he finds Paul innocent. But what we find even more interesting in this passage is that it says in verse 19 that he hears the truth about this man named Jesus. He even recites some of those details back to Agrippa in verse 19, that Paul has claimed that this guy who is claiming to be the Son of God rose from the dead. And yet, even though he knows the details about Jesus and the gospel, even though he is more moral than his predecessor, his heart remains unchanged and uninterested. Why is the question? at the beginning of verse 19, it says that, well, you know what? It seems to me that this is just a point of contention between you people of the same religion about this guy named Jesus. So what's really going on when we read this in Festus' mind and heart? We see that he has all the information about Jesus, but experiences none of the transformation. He has everything he needs to know about Jesus, but he fails to see Jesus as relevant to him. Instead, he sees Jesus as only an internal Jewish cultural issue. This Jesus stuff, it just seems like minor quibbles between two factions of the same religion. It's about you Jewish people. It's about your culture, your differences. It doesn't have anything to do with me. It's irrelevant to my life. It's irrelevant to my world. I respect your beliefs, but they're really not for me. And so I see this issue as a Jewish thing, not a Roman thing, and definitely not a Festus thing. Why don't we see or experience Jesus at times? You see, Festus's blindness can be our blindness too, where we can hear God's truth, but likewise we fail to see Jesus as relevant to me and to my life. Some of you know that I was the youth pastor in this church for many years prior, and there was one young man who I remember I would have long conversations with, and we would go out and kind of talk about how he's doing and what his life was like, but we'd always come back to talking about how's he feeling about a relationship with Jesus. And to him, he kind of grew up in church, and his response was, well, you know, it's just cultural, like this Christianity stuff. I just grew up in it. My family just happened to be, I grew up in a family that happens to go to church, and I've heard the gospel a million times, and I read the Bible, and it's boring, and I pray, and it's boring, and church is boring, and all this stuff is boring to me. It's irrelevant. Until when? Until something goes wrong in his life. Then he started praying, like this guy who claimed like God has no relevance to his life. He's on his knees crying and praying, please, God, help me, have mercy on me, right? And he is searching the Bible diligently for some nugget of truth that will help him in his times of trouble. Then he's coming to his friends in youth group and to me as his pastor begging, can you guys please pray for me? I really need help in this area. The result was he actually began to experience Jesus' peace and comfort in the midst of those tough times. He actually began to also experience God's mercy and deliverance to get him through those difficulties. Bless you. And so I asked him the question, you know, you've seen what God can do in your life when things are tough. But what if Jesus isn't only relevant for help and hope in times of trouble, but even during the good times? What if you're missing out on the kind of life, the kind of freedom, the kind of joy, the kind of purpose that you could have if you only trusted Jesus and his truth? Nah! Why? Because then I'd have to change. You see, the real reason that we do not see and experience Jesus, same as Festus, is because if the gospel is true about Jesus, then it actually is relevant to our lives. It's not irrelevant, because if God's truth in Jesus isn't just about cultural differences, then it requires me to respond to it. It requires me to change. When we come face to face with the truth about Jesus, the truth about him and his life and his ways, it's very counter, it runs counter to our sin-stained human nature, which is cross-cultural, whether or not you are Jewish, Roman, Asian, or American, doesn't matter what you are, but it is cross-cultural. And for Festus, his thing is, instead of trusting in the life that is available through Jesus, I like the life that I have. It's comfortable. I have influence as a governor, even though what he saw in his predecessor is that you can lose that in an instant. And I don't want to bow to Jesus as Lord, because even in verse 26 later on, he'll call Caesar his Lord out of fear for the emperor. And the reality is, a lot of times, I like to be Lord over my own life. I like to do it my way. I like to call the shots. And so we blindfold ourselves to the life-changing truth from Jesus, telling ourselves, you know what, that doesn't apply to me. It's irrelevant because I like my life the way it is. I like that there are certain sins that I kind of keep in my back pocket. Sure, you know, God can clean up every area, but there are certain things that I want to indulge in for myself. I don't like having to answer to anyone else. And if Jesus is true, and if Jesus is relevant, then it requires that I allow Jesus to change things in my life, my priorities, and my lifestyle. Who or what is Lord over my dollars and my days and my choices? And so the question I want to start with this morning is, how are you and I covering our own eyes this morning? How do we live as if Jesus is not relevant to you? But really it's just about, well, I don't want to change or be changed by God. If you are not following Jesus yet, at some point you're going to have to come to grips with the truth that life is finite and someday I will face an infinite creator that is worthy of our trust, that is worthy of our reverence. And that without Jesus, this short breath of life that we have is just a drop in the bucket. And this is as close to heaven as we will ever get in this life, if without Jesus. But if we acknowledge that we do sin by nature and by choice, that we rebel against God, that we don't go His way, then we can repent, which means we turn from our sin to God by faith in Jesus. That we accept and believe that Jesus died in our place for our sins and rose to be our Savior and trust the life, our lives to Him as Lord, then it only gets better from here. Not easier, but it gets better when you follow Jesus. For those of us who do follow Jesus, it's easier to kind of say, well, this isn't relevant to me this morning. I believe and have faith and life in Jesus, and I know that it's relevant to me. But let me ask you a very hard question. Let's get real with ourselves. If someone were to observe your life, would they see Jesus' truth and transformation being experienced in your daily life? Not just that, yes, I believe and know that I have eternal life, not just when I'm at church, but is Jesus relevant where the rubber meets the road? Am I willing to let Jesus change me? Is my relationship to Jesus relevant to me on a day-by-day basis throughout the day, or only just before meals I'll talk to Him, or during stressful meetings, or when I have stressful deadlines? Is Jesus relevant to how I do my work, in my attitude, in the quality of my work, in the effort that I put in? Is Jesus relevant in how I treat people at work? Is Jesus relevant to the decisions I make about my time and my resources, about my family and my leisure time? Is Jesus relevant to how worried and anxious I get? Is Jesus relevant to not just your behavior on the softball field, but to your attitude on it, towards your teammates and towards your opponents? Are you gracious when other people make mistakes? Are you gracious when you are in victory? Is Jesus relevant in your daily life? Perhaps we don't see and experience Jesus, though He is invisible to us at the moment, because the place that He wants to reveal Himself to us, where He wants us to see Him, where He wants to pour His truth and His life and His change into us, we're resisting that. And we treat Jesus as if He's irrelevant. But maybe He wants you to see Him in those very areas that He's looking to change. Let's move on to verse 20. Being at a loss, this is Festus continuing to talk, how to investigate these questions, I asked whether Paul wanted to go to Jerusalem and be tried there regarding them. But when Paul had appealed to be kept in custody for the decision of the emperor, I ordered him to be held until I could send him to Caesar. Then Agrippa said to Festus, I would like to hear the man myself. Tomorrow, said he, you will hear him. So on the next day, Agrippa and Bernice came with great pomp, and they entered the audience hall with the military tribunes, the generals, and the prominent men of the city. Then, at the command of Festus, Paul was brought in. And Festus said, King Agrippa, and all who are present with us, you see this man about whom the whole Jewish people petitioned me, both in Jerusalem and here. shouting that he ought not to live any longer. But I found that he had done nothing deserving death. And as he himself appealed to the emperor, I decided to go ahead and send him. But I have nothing definite to write to my lord, to Caesar, about him. Therefore, I have brought him before you all, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that after we have examined him, I may have something to write. For it seems to me unreasonable in sending a prisoner not to indicate the charges against him. Makes sense, right? He's supposed to send Paul to Caesar, but it's kind of like, what are you sending him here for? I don't know, right? And so in verse 20, he's basically saying, I have no idea how to investigate what I consider just differences of opinion within the same culture, within the same religion. So he tried to see if Paul was willing to get tried in Jerusalem, because he'd love to pass the buck on this Jewish issue back to the Jewish people, and also to get some political favor, as we saw back in verse 9 that Dennis preached on last week. But in verse 21, Paul complicated things, right? He said, as a Roman citizen, I hereby exercise my right to be kept under house arrest and appeal to see the emperor, to have him rule on my case. And so in verse 22, Agrippa Jr., he says, I'm curious, I want to hear what this fellow Jewish dude has to say. And Festus says, okay, I'll set it up tomorrow. So here's where it gets interesting. In verse 23, Festus says to says about Junior and his sister Bernice, they arrive with great pomp, and with all the royal dignitaries, with all the military generals, with all the prominent men of the city. And you can imagine in your mind that they come in all their splendor and regalia. There's all this pomp and circumstance of trumpets and musicians. There's some official that's announcing each dignitary or celebrity's arrival. And now King Agrippa II has arrived on the red carpet, sporting a stylish Armani suit. And his sister Bernice is in a very risque, Vera Wang dress, but there's something weird about her hair today. Okay, everyone pose for the photos, right? And so amidst all the celebration of the wealthy, of the powerful, of the influential, all this self-congratulatory extravagance is brought in a ragged man in chains for Jesus. And of course, the question that Festus, that we should be asking Festus is, who are you going to believe? Whose voice do you think carries more weight to him? And in verse 24 to 27, Festus kind of sums up all this stuff, and he specifically addresses Agrippa Jr. and all the people around here. This dude that all the religious leaders are accusing deserved the death penalty, I find that there's no Roman legal standing for us to execute him. He's innocent. But as his right, he appealed to Caesar, but I have no idea what are the official charges I'm going to write, and I'm not interested in getting reprimanded from the emperor for wasting his time, so I need some help. And the key here is in verse 26. He says, that's why I brought him before you all, especially before you, King Agrippa. You see, Junior here, he has quite a rep. Agrippa Jr., he is considered historically an expert on the Jewish religion, on Jewish law, by his contemporaries of the time. In fact, Caesar actually gave him the authority to be able to appoint who is going to be the high priest over the nation of Israel, even though Israel doesn't have any political power of its own right now. And so he's considered an expert on the Jewish religion by the Romans. And what's happening here is that Festus kind of turns to Agrippa Jr. and says, Junior, I'm going to trust your opinion because you appear to be an expert on these matters. You see, first, he was dazzled by the pomp and the reputation of this man. I'm going to trust you because you look important, you talk important, you act important, you carry yourself with an air of authority. So I choose to respect your robes, your throne, your rule, more than the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. His name is Jesus. And secondly, he states that I don't really have a clue about this Jewish religion stuff, so I'm going to trust you because you seem to have more knowledge and insight, and I'm going to choose to rely on your opinion on the matter. Another reason that we are unable to see Jesus in our lives is that we also get sidetracked because we rely on expert opinions over God's truth. You see, we allow others to mislead us because we're swayed by the pomp of personal presentation or the appearance of authority by a pundit that sounds smart who seems like he's in the know. And I think about how often someone who's very articulate, a professor, a colleague, a Reddit article that you read convinces you that Jesus and his word have inaccuracies or inconsistencies and contradictions. Or maybe somebody who sounds very spiritual, maybe they have a lot of religious credentials. Maybe they are ordained in their own religion. And they speak contrary to Jesus and his word. And we believe that person instead of doing our due diligence and investigating the source material ourselves. Even in Christian circles, those who claim to speak the truth, but maybe it doesn't match up with the teaching about Jesus from the Word of God, yet we don't bother to question it or discover it for ourselves. Even if I or another pastor were to tell you things, would you simply blindly accept what people say just because they look like an expert? Galatians 1:8, Paul will write, "But even if we," Paul and his missionaries, "or an angel from heaven preach a gospel contrary to what you were originally taught, let him be damned." That is the original language. We soften it up in English to accursed or anathema or this or that. But it means let him be cursed, damned, sent to hell. If somebody teaches a gospel different to what was taught through Jesus and his word. Even if I myself, Paul, say that. And so the key here is that you're not simply trusting in my words or some expert's words, but my confidence is in Jesus and his word. You see, there's tons of armchair philosophers and theologians with a little bit of truth. Kind of like somebody hacking a screen name who happens to know the person they're hacking. Just enough to take us partway into believing them. And then we allow their appearance or their reputation to fill in the blanks. And it sways us from trusting and experiencing God's truth without confronting whether or not what they're saying is true. And so the application for you this morning is that we need to test and verify if something is truth. That we ourselves can examine God's word. We can examine original source materials, ancient texts. Like, you know, a lot of times people will tell me, well, you know, the Bible's been translated so many times and into English has been hundreds and thousands of years, and so there's a lot of inaccuracies and inconsistencies. We can go back to first century documents that are almost literally within the lifetime of people who were living at the time that of the Gospel and the New Testament. And same thing with other original source documents. So we can see that there are not inconsistencies, that it hasn't been corrupted. You can take a look at people's various religion or statements of fact and historicity and actually find out whether or not it's true or not. In Deuteronomy chapter 18, God gives us some counsel about what to do in order to figure these things out. How will you know if someone is speaking prophetic truth? And it gives a very simple test for it. Does it actually come true? Is it actually true? Right? Is it point away from God and his word? And in 1 John chapter 4, verse 1, we're counseled to test the spirits, whether or not it's from God. It reminds me of recently, one of our college students sent me an email, and they were being bombarded by a friend who was concerned about them as a Christian, because they were concerned, this atheist friend was concerned that, well, you're being brainwashed by religion. And in some ways, I actually appreciate this young man's email to this college student, because I don't want you to simply believe someone else's expertise, but we need to examine source material. We need to examine facts and truths for ourselves. And the things that he was claiming was, well, I don't want you to just kind of be brainwashed into Christianity, because Jesus is based on all these other mythologies that predate the coming of Jesus. There's a whole bunch of myths that claim some godlike figure claims to be the Son of God, and that they're sent to die, and then they rise from the dead to save us. And there's a whole list. They sent us. There was a link that they sent with all this list of people like Buddha or Krishna or the Egyptian god Horus or Zoroaster or the Greek god Dionysus or et cetera, et cetera. I could go on and on. But basically, that all of these also claim to be the sons of some kind of god that died and rose again. And it kind of, you know, rocked this college student a little bit. They didn't know how to answer. And as I started reading through the articles and links that they sent, I said, well, you know what? It sounds smart. It sounds really authoritative. But I recognize that, you know what? It's not actually intellectually honest, because many of the comparisons are historically and factually inaccurate and have been kind of bent somewhat to fit this person's theory. And it doesn't take much digging around. You can see there's plainly available lots of things, comparisons that you can make with ancient source documents, and that maybe this person needs to take a look at their own personal biases against Jesus. So my question for you is, do you test what people know, what people say, and see if it's true? Or are we intellectually lazy and we rely on expert opinion because it sounds smart, because it has the appearance of authority? And I don't even want you to rely simply on the pre-digested words of a pastor. Do you, on a daily basis, examine and test to see if Jesus and his word are true? Because that's one of my concerns for Christians. A lot of times, well, the pastor said this, the pastor said that. But do you know what God actually says in his word? Do you test what people know and say to be true? Secondly, I'm not telling you to test God, but do you actually examine and test to see if Jesus and his word are true? Now, like I said, we're not saying that you should test God, but God makes certain promises that when we trust in his work through Jesus to save us, to change us, that we can bank on those promises. There is tangible fruit in our lives. And so I want to challenge you, if you are a Christian or even not a Christian, this both applies to you, that you would take the risk to test and trust and see if Jesus really does keep his promises, if he really does rescue us from sin and death, if he really does give us peace beyond our understanding, if he really does provide for our needs when we persistently ask, if he really does give us words and wisdom when we are under fire and under pressure, if he really does give us joy in the midst of life's storms, if he really does give us courage and strength to live out his integrity, there is a reality about Jesus that we can see and test and compare to what other people claim and find what is true and what is not. You see, we often don't see and experience Jesus because of wrong perspectives about God's truth, whether or not it is relevant to me, whether or not it is reliable based on other people's opinions. And we discover through Paul's brief interaction with Festus that the roadblocks in our human experience that prevent us from seeing Jesus aren't necessarily because Jesus is at fault, but because of our own misconceptions. You see, Jesus is not an invisible God. We can see him. We can experience his work and his presence. We find that there's genuine relevancy in our lives if we're willing to be changed for his glory, for our good. We find a God who's willing to go the distance and prove himself to be true, and he will pit himself against any so-called expert opinion or theory. And most of all, we find a God whom no earthly eye can behold his complete magnificent glory and live, and yet he was willing to enter into physical reality in the very real, historical, human form of Jesus, the God who meets us where we are. This morning, I want you to take a quick moment just to bow in a word of prayer. I don't want to just talk about seeing an invisible God, but I want you to see if you are ready to give him an opportunity to meet with you. There's a God who died, who rose, who ascended to his Father. His name is Jesus. And if you really want to experience him, then I want to challenge you to experience how relevant he really can be. I dare you to invite Jesus to reveal areas of your life that need his change this. And then I dare you to allow him to do that. Challenge you to experience how he stands up to any contrary expert. Ask him to show you what lies and opinions you buy into. Ask him for wisdom and courage to test and verify if they're true or if his word is. And then take a risk and see if his promises are true for yourself. See if you won't see Jesus' presence and work and see the invisible God for yourself.